Match the size of the organization to the size of the market. Managers who confront disruptive technological change must be leaders, not followers, in commercializing disruptive technologies. Doing so requires implanting the projects that are to develop such technologies in commercial organizations that match in size the market they are to address. These assertions are based on two key findings of this study: that leadership is more crucial in coping with disruptive technologies than with sustaining ones, and that small, emerging markets cannot solve the near-term growth and profit requirements of large companies. Creating new markets is significantly less risky and more rewarding than entering established markets against entrenched competition. But as companies become larger and more successful, it becomes even more difficult to enter emerging markets early enough, because growing companies need to add increasingly large chunks of new revenue each year just to maintain their desired rate of growth. It becomes less and less possible that small markets can be viable as vehicles through which to find these chunks of revenue. As we shall see, the most straightforward way of confronting this difficulty is to implant projects aimed at commercializing disruptive technologies in organizations small enough to get excited about small market opportunities, and to do so on a regular basis, even while the mainstream company is growing. A crucial strategic decision in the management of innovation is whether it's important to be a leader or acceptable to be a follower. Volumes have been written on first-mover advantages and an offsetting amount on the wisdom of waiting until the innovation's major risks have been resolved by the pioneering firms. You can always tell who the pioneers were. An old management adage goes, "They're the ones with the arrows in their backs." As with most disagreements in management theory, neither position is always right. Indeed, some findings from the study of the disk drive industry give some insight into when leadership is critical and when followership makes better sense. In contrast to the evidence that leadership in sustaining technologies has historically conferred little advantage on the pioneering disk drive firms, there is strong evidence that leadership in disruptive technology has been very important. The companies that entered the new value networks enabled by disruptive generations of disk drives within the first 2 years after those drives appeared were 6 times more likely to succeed than those that entered later. Despite evidence that leadership in disruptive innovation pays such huge dividends, established firms often fail to take the lead. Customers of established firms can hold the organizations captive, working through rational, well-functioning resource allocation processes to keep them from commercializing disruptive technologies. One cruel additional disabling factor that afflicts established firms as they work to maintain their growth rate is that the larger and more successful they become, the more difficult it is to muster the rationale for entering an emerging market in its early stages when the evidence above shows that entry is so crucial. Companies that become large and successful find that maintaining growth becomes progressively more difficult. The math is simple. A $40 million company that needs to grow profitably at 20% to sustain its stock price and organizational vitality needs an additional $8 million in revenues the first year, $9.6 million the following year, and so on. A $400 million company with a 20% targeted growth rate needs new business worth $80 million in the first year, $96 million in the next, and so on. And a $4 billion company with a 20% goal needs to find $800 million, $960 million, and so on in each successive year. This problem is particularly vexing for big companies confronting disruptive technologies. Disruptive technologies facilitate the emergence of new markets, and there are no $800 million emerging markets. But it's precisely when emerging markets are small When they are least attractive to large companies in search of big chunks of new revenue, that entry into them is so critical. How can a manager of a large, successful company deal with these realities of size and growth when confronted by disruptive change? I've observed three approaches in my study of this problem. First, try to affect the growth rate of the emerging market so that it becomes big enough, fast enough, to make a meaningful dent on the trajectory of profit and revenue growth of a large company. Second, wait until the market has emerged and become better defined, and then enter after it has become large enough to be interesting. Third, place responsibility to commercialize disruptive technologies in organizations small enough that their performance will be meaningfully affected by the revenues, profits, and small orders flowing from the disruptive business in its earliest years. As the following case studies show, the first two approaches are fraught with problems. The third has its share of drawbacks too, but offers more evidence of promise. The history of Apple Computer's early entry into the handheld computer, or PDA, personal digital assistant market, helps to clarify the difficulties confronting large companies in small markets. Apple Computer introduced its Apple I in 1976. It was, at best, a preliminary product with limited functionality, and the company sold a total of 200 units at $666 each before withdrawing it from the market. But the Apple I wasn't a financial disaster. Apple had spent modestly on its development, and both Apple and its customers learned a lot about how desktop personal computers might be used. Apple incorporated this learning into its Apple II computer, introduced in 1977, which was highly successful. Apple sold 43,000 Apple II computers in the first 2 years they were on the market, and the product's success positioned the company as the leader in the personal computer industry. On the basis of the Apple II's success, Apple went public in 1980. A decade after the release of the Apple II, Apple Computer had grown into a $5 billion company, and like all large and successful companies, it found itself having to add large chunks of revenue each year to preserve its equity value and organizational vitality. In the early 1990s, the emerging market for handheld PDAs presented itself as a potential vehicle for achieving that needed growth. In many ways, this opportunity, analogous to that in 1978 when the Apple II computer helped shape its industry, was a great fit for Apple. Apple's distinctive design expertise was in user-friendly products, and user-friendliness and convenience were the basis of the PDA concept. How did Apple approach this opportunity? Aggressively. It invested scores of millions of dollars to develop its product, dubbed the Newton. The Newton's features were defined through one of the most thoroughly executed market research efforts in corporate history. Focus groups and surveys of every type were used to determine what features consumers would want. The PDA had many of the characteristics of a disruptive computing technology. And recognizing the potential problems, Apple CEO John Sculley made the Newton's development a personal priority, promoting the product widely and ensuring that the effort got the technical and financial resources it needed. Apple sold 140,000 Newtons in 1993 and 94, its first 2 years on the market. Most observers, of course, viewed the Newton as a big flop. Technically, its handwriting recognition capabilities were disappointing, and its wireless communications technologies had made it expensive. But what was most damning was that while Sculley had publicly positioned the Newton as a key product to sustain the company's growth, its first-year sales amounted to about 1% of Apple's revenues. Despite all the effort, the Newton made hardly a dent in Apple's need for new growth. But was the Newton a failure? The timing of Newton's entry into the handheld market was akin to the timing of the Apple II into the desktop market. It was a market-creating, disruptive product targeted at an undefinable set of users whose needs were unknown to either themselves or Apple. On that basis, Newton's sales should have been a pleasant surprise to Apple's executives. It outsold the Apple II in its first 2 years by a factor of more than 3 to 1. But while selling 43,000 units was viewed as an IPO qualifying triumph in the smaller Apple of 1979, selling 140,000 Newtons was viewed as a failure in the giant Apple of 1994. Disruptive technologies often enable something to be done that previously had been deemed impossible. Because of this, when they initially emerge, neither manufacturers nor customers know how or why the products will be used, and hence, don't know what specific features of the product will and will not ultimately be valued. Building such markets entails a process of mutual discovery by customers and manufacturers, and this simply takes time. In Apple's development of the desktop computer, for example, the Apple I failed, the first Apple II was lackluster, and the Apple II Plus succeeded. The Apple III was a market failure because of quality problems, and the Lisa was a failure. The first two generations of the Macintosh computer also stumbled. It wasn't until the third iteration of the Macintosh that Apple and its customers finally found it. The standard for convenient, user-friendly computing to which the rest of the industry ultimately had to conform. In launching the Newton, however, Apple was desperate to short-circuit this coalescent process for defining the ultimate product and market. It assumed that its customers knew what they wanted and spent very aggressively to find out what this was. In a few minutes, I'll tell you why this is impossible. Then, to give customers what they thought they wanted, Apple had to assume the precarious role of a sustaining technology leader in an emerging industry. It spent enormous sums to push mobile data communications and handwriting recognition technologies beyond the state of the art. And finally, it spent aggressively to convince people to buy what it had designed. Because emerging markets are small by definition, the organizations competing in them must be able to become profitable at small scale. This is crucial because organizations or projects that are perceived as being profitable and successful can continue to attract financial and human resources, both from their corporate parents and from capital markets. Initiatives perceived as failures have a difficult time attracting either. Unfortunately, the scale of the investments Apple made in its Newton in order to hasten the emergence of the PDA market made it very difficult to earn an attractive return. Hence, the Newton came to be broadly viewed as a flop. As with most business disappointments, hindsight reveals the faults in Apple's Newton project. But I believe that the root cause of Apple's struggle was not inappropriate management. The executives' actions were a symptom of a deeper problem. Small markets cannot satisfy the near-term growth requirements of big organizations. A second way that many large companies have responded to the disruptive technology trap is to wait for emerging markets to get large enough to be interesting before they enter. Sometimes this works, as IBM's well-timed 1981 entry into the desktop PC business demonstrated. But it's a seductive logic that can backfire, because the firms creating new markets often forge capabilities that are closely attuned to the requirements of those markets, and that later entrants find difficult to replicate. An example from the disk drive industry illustrates this problem. Priam Corporation, which ascended to leadership of the market for 8-inch drives sold to mini computer makers after its entry in 1978, had built the capability in that market to develop its drives on a 2-year rhythm. This pace of new product introduction was consistent with the rhythm by which its customers, mini computer makers, introduced their new products into the market. Seagate's first 5.25-inch drive, introduced to the emerging desktop market in 1980, was disruptively slow compared to the performance of Priam's drives in the mini computer market. But by 1983, Seagate and other firms that led in implementing the disruptive 5.25-inch technology had developed a one-year product introduction rhythm in their market. Because Seagate and Priam achieved similar percentage improvements in speed with each new product generation, Seagate, by introducing new generations on a one-year rhythm, quickly began to converge on Priam's performance advantage. Priam introduced its first 5.25-inch drive in 1982, but the rhythm by which it introduced its subsequent 5.25-inch models was the two-year capability it had honed in the mini computer market, not the one-year cycle required to compete in the desktop marketplace. As a consequence, it was never able to secure a single major OEM order from a desktop computer manufacturer. It just couldn't hit their design windows with its new products. And Seagate, by taking many more steps forward than did Priam, was able to close the performance gap between them. Priam closed its doors in 1990. Our third case study is about giving small opportunities to small organizations. Every innovation is difficult. That difficulty is compounded immeasurably, however, when a project is embedded in an organization in which most people are continually questioning why the project is being done at all. Projects make sense to people if they address the needs of important customers, if they positively impact the organization's need for profit and growth, and if participating in the project enhances the career opportunities of talented employees. When a project doesn't have these characteristics, its manager spends much time and energy justifying why it merits resources and cannot manage the project as effectively. Frequently, in such circumstances, the best people don't want to be associated with the project. And when things get tight, projects viewed as non-essential are the first to be canceled or postponed. Executives can give an enormous boost to a project's probability of success when they ensure that it's being executed in an environment in which everyone involved views the endeavor as crucial to the organization's future growth and profitability. Under these conditions, when the inevitable disappointments, unforeseen problems, and schedule slippages occur, the organization will be more likely to find ways to muster whatever is required to solve the problem. As we've seen, a project to commercialize a disruptive technology in a small emerging market is very unlikely to be considered essential to success in a large company. Small markets don't solve the growth problems of big companies. Rather than continually working to convince and remind everyone that the small disruptive technology might someday be significant, or that it's at least strategically important, large companies should seek to embed the project in an organization that is small enough to be motivated by the opportunity offered by a disruptive technology in its early years. There are many success stories to the credit of this approach. Control Data, for example, which had essentially missed the 8-inch disk drive generation, sent a group to Oklahoma City to commercialize its 5.25-inch drive. In addition to CDC's need to escape the power of its mainstream customers, the firm explicitly wanted to create an organization whose size matched the opportunity. "We needed an organization," reflected one manager, "that could get excited about a $50,000 order. In Minneapolis, which derived nearly $1 billion from the sale of 14-inch drives in the mainframe market, you needed a $1 million order just to turn anyone's head." CDC's Oklahoma City venture proved to be a significant success. Another way of matching the size of an organization to the size of the opportunity is to acquire a small company within which to incubate the disruptive technology. Johnson & Johnson has, with great success, followed this strategy in dealing with disruptive technologies, such as endoscopic surgical equipment and disposable contact lenses. Though its total revenues amount to more than $20 billion, J&J comprises 160 autonomously operating companies, which range from its huge McNeil & Janssen pharmaceuticals companies to small companies with annual revenues of less than $20 million. Johnson & Johnson's strategy is to launch products of disruptive technologies through very small companies acquired for that purpose. To reiterate, despite the evidence that leadership in commercializing disruptive technologies is crucial, large successful innovators encounter a significant dilemma in the pursuit of such leadership. In addition to dealing with the power of present customers as discussed previously, large growth-oriented companies face the problem that small markets don't solve the near-term growth needs of large companies. The markets whose emergence is enabled by disruptive technologies all began as small ones. The first orders that the pioneering companies received in those markets were small ones, and the companies that cultivated those markets had to develop cost structures enabling them to become profitable at small scale. Each of these factors argues for a policy of implanting projects to commercialize disruptive innovations in small organizations that will view the projects as being on their critical path to growth and success, rather than as being distractions from the main business of the company. Discovering new and emerging markets. Markets that don't exist can't be analyzed. Suppliers and customers must discover them together. Not only are the market applications for disruptive technologies unknown at the time of their development, they are unknowable. The strategies and plans that managers formulate for confronting disruptive technological change, therefore, should be plans for learning and discovery rather than plans for execution. This is an important point to understand, because managers who believe they know a market's future will plan and invest very differently from those who recognize the uncertainties of a developing market. Most managers learn about innovation in a sustaining technology context, because most technologies developed by established companies are sustaining in character. Such innovations are, by definition, targeted at known markets in which customer needs are understood. In this environment, a planned, researched approach to evaluating, developing, and marketing innovative products is not only possible, it is critical to success. What this means, however, is that much of what the best executives in successful companies have learned about managing innovation is not relevant to disruptive technologies. Most marketers, for example, have been schooled extensively at universities and on the job in the important art of listening to their customers. But few have any theoretical or practical training in how to discover markets that don't yet exist. The problem with this lopsided experience base is that when the same analytical and decision-making processes learned in the school of sustaining innovation are applied to enabling or disruptive technologies, the effect on the company can be paralyzing. These processes demand crisply quantified information when none exists, accurate estimates of financial returns when neither revenues nor costs can be known, and management according to detailed plans and budgets that cannot be formulated. Applying inappropriate marketing, investment, and management processes can render good companies incapable of creating the new markets in which enabling or disruptive technologies are first used. Let's look at how experts in the disk drive industry were able to forecast the markets for sustaining technologies with stunning accuracy, but had great difficulty in spotting the advent and predicting the size of new markets for disruptive innovations. An unusual amount of market information has been available about the disk drive industry from its earliest days. A major reason why studying it has yielded such rich insights. The primary source of data, Disk Trend Report, published annually by Disk Trend Inc. of Mountain View, California, lists every model of disk drive that has ever been offered for sale by any company in the world for each of the years from 1975 to the present. Of the five new architectures for which Disk Trend's forecasts are available, the 14-inch Winchester and the 2.5-inch generation were sustaining innovations, which were sold into the same value networks as the preceding generation of drives. The other three, 5.25, 3.5, and 1.8-inch drives, were disruptive innovations that facilitated the emergence of new value networks. Disk Trend's forecasts for the sustaining 2.5-inch and 14-inch Winchester technologies were within 8% and 7% respectively of what the industry actually shipped. But its estimates were off by 265% for 5.25-inch drives, 35% for 3.5-inch drives, which is really quite close, and 550% for 1.8-inch drives. Notably, the 1.8-inch drive, the forecast of which Disk Trend missed so badly, was the first generation of drives with a primarily non-computer market. The Disk Trend staff used the same models to generate the forecasts for sustaining architectures as they did for disruptive ones, interviewing leading customers and industry experts, trend analysis, economic modeling, and so on. The techniques that worked so extraordinarily well when applied to sustaining technologies, however, clearly failed badly when applied to markets or applications that did not yet exist. The reaction of some managers to the difficulty of correctly planning the markets for disruptive technologies is to work harder and plan smarter. While this approach works for sustaining innovations, it denies the evidence about the nature of disruptive ones. Amid all the uncertainty surrounding disruptive technologies, managers can always count on one anchor. Experts' forecasts will always be wrong. It's simply impossible to predict with any useful degree of precision how disruptive products will be used or how large their markets will be. An important corollary is that because markets for disruptive technologies are unpredictable, companies' initial strategies for entering these markets will generally be wrong. Research has shown, in fact, that the vast majority of successful new business ventures abandoned their original business strategies when they began implementing their initial plans and learned what would and would not work in the market. The dominant difference between successful ventures and failed ones, generally, is not the astuteness of their original strategy. Guessing the right strategy at the outset isn't nearly as important to success as conserving enough resources or having the relationships with trusting backers or investors so that new business initiatives get a second or third stab at getting it right. Those that run out of resources or credibility before they can iterate toward a viable strategy are the ones that fail. In most companies, individual managers don't have the luxury of surviving a string of trials and errors in pursuit of the strategy that works. Rightly or wrongly, individual managers in most organizations believe that they cannot fail. If they champion a project that fails because the initial marketing plan was wrong, it will constitute a blotch on their track record, blocking their rise through the organization. Because failure is intrinsic to the process of finding new markets for disruptive technologies, the inability or unwillingness of individual managers to put their careers at risk acts as a powerful deterrent to the movement of established firms into the value networks created by those technologies. As Joseph Bauer observed in his classic study of the resource allocation process at a major chemical company, pressure from the market reduces both the probability and the cost of being wrong. Bauer's observation is consistent with my findings about the disk drive industry. When demand for an innovation was assured, as was the case with sustaining technologies, the industry's established leaders were capable of placing huge, long, and risky bets to develop whatever technology was required. When demand was not assured, as was the case in disruptive technologies, the established firms could not even make the technologically straightforward bets required to commercialize such innovations. That's why 65% of the companies entering the disk drive industry attempted to do so in an established rather than emerging market. Discovering markets for emerging technologies inherently involves failure, and most individual decision makers find it very difficult to risk backing a project that might fail because the market is not there. Because failure is intrinsic to the search for initial market applications for disruptive technologies, managers need an approach very different from what they would take toward a sustaining technology. In general, for sustaining technologies, plans must be made before action is taken. Forecasts can be accurate, and customer inputs can be reasonably reliable. Careful planning, followed by aggressive execution, is the right formula for success in sustaining technology. But in disruptive situations, action must be taken before careful plans are made. Because much less can be known about what markets need or how large they can become, plans must serve a very different purpose. They must be plans for learning rather than plans for implementation. By approaching a disruptive business with the mindset that they can't know where the market is, managers would identify what critical information about new markets is most necessary and in what sequence that information is needed. Project and business plans would mirror those priorities so that key pieces of information would be created or important uncertainties resolved before expensive commitments of capital, time, and money were required. Discovery-driven planning, which requires managers to identify the assumptions upon which their business plans or aspirations are based, works well in addressing disruptive technologies. Philosophies such as management by objective and management by exception often impede the discovery of new markets because of where they focus management attention. Typically, when performance falls short of plan, these systems encourage management to close the gap between what was planned and what happened. That is, they focus on unanticipated failures. But markets for disruptive technologies often emerge from unanticipated successes, on which many planning systems do not focus the attention of senior management. Such discoveries often come by watching how people use products rather than by listening to what they say. I've come to call this approach to discovering the emerging markets for disruptive technologies agnostic marketing, by which I mean marketing under an explicit assumption that no one, not us, not our customers, can know whether, how, or in what quantities a disruptive product can or will be used before they have experience using it. Some managers, faced with such uncertainty, prefer to wait until others have defined the market. Given the powerful first-mover advantages at stake, however, managers confronting disruptive technologies need to get out of their laboratories and focus groups and directly create knowledge about new customers and new applications through discovery-driven expeditions into the marketplace. How to appraise your organization's capabilities and disabilities. When managers assign employees to tackle a critical innovation, they instinctively work to match the requirements of the job with the capabilities of the individuals whom they charge to do it. In evaluating whether an employee is capable of successfully executing a job, managers will assess whether he or she has the requisite knowledge, judgment, skill, perspective, and energy. Managers will also assess the employee's values, the criteria by which he or she tends to decide what should and shouldn't be done. Indeed, the hallmark of a great manager is the ability to identify the right person for the right job and to train his or her employees so that they have the capabilities to succeed at the jobs they are given. Unfortunately, some managers don't think as rigorously about whether their organizations have the capability to successfully execute jobs that may be given to them. Frequently, they assume that if the people working on a project individually have the requisite capabilities to get the job done well, then the organization in which they work will also have the same capability to succeed. This often is not the case. One could take two sets of identically capable people and put them to work in two different organizations, and what they accomplish would likely be significantly different. This is because organizations themselves, independent of the people and other resources in them, have capabilities. To succeed consistently, good managers need to be skilled, not just in choosing, training, and motivating the right people for the right job, but in choosing, building, and preparing the right organization for the job as well. The notion that organizations have core competencies has been a popular one for much of the last decade. In practice, however, most managers have found that the concept is sufficiently vague that some supposed competence can be cited in support of a bewildering variety of innovation proposals. Let me bring greater precision to the core competence concept by presenting a framework to help managers understand, when they're confronted with a necessary change, whether the organizations over which they preside are competent or incompetent of tackling the challenges that lie ahead. Three classes of factors affect what an organization can and cannot do: its resources, its processes, and its values. When asking what sorts of innovations their organizations are and are not likely to be able to implement successfully, managers can learn a lot about capabilities by disaggregating their answers into these three categories. Resources are the most visible of the factors that contribute to what an organization can and cannot do. Resources include people, equipment, technology, product designs, brands, information, cash, and relationships with suppliers, distributors, and customers. Resources are usually things, assets. They can be hired and fired, bought and sold, depreciated, or enhanced. They often can be transferred across the boundaries of organizations much more readily than can processes and values. Without doubt, access to abundant and high-quality resources enhances an organization's chances of coping with change. Resources are the things that managers most instinctively identify when assessing whether their organizations can successfully implement changes that confront them. Yet, resource analysis clearly does not tell a sufficient story about capabilities. Indeed, we could deal identical sets of resources to two different organizations, and what they created from those resources would likely be very different. Because the capabilities to transform inputs into goods and services of greater value reside in the organization's processes and values. Organizations create value as employees transform inputs of resources, people, equipment, technology, product designs, brands, information, energy, and cash, into products and services of greater worth. The patterns of interaction, coordination, communication, and decision-making through which they accomplish these transformations are processes. Processes include not just manufacturing processes, but those by which product development, procurement, market research, budgeting, planning, employee development and compensation, and resource allocation are accomplished. Processes differ not only in their purpose, but also in their visibility. Some processes are formal, in the sense that they are explicitly defined, visibly documented, and consciously followed. Other processes are informal, in that they are habitual routines or ways of working that have evolved over time, which people follow simply because they work, or because that's the way we do things around here. Still other methods of working and interacting have proven so effective for so long that people unconsciously follow them. They constitute the culture of the organization. Whether they are formal, informal, or cultural, however, processes define how an organization transforms the sorts of inputs I just mentioned into things of greater value. One of the dilemmas of management is that, by their very nature, processes are established so that employees perform recurrent tasks in a consistent way, time after time. This means that the very mechanisms through which organizations create value are intrinsically inimical to change. Some of the most crucial processes to examine as capabilities or disabilities are the enabling or background processes that support investment decision-making. As we saw earlier, the processes that render good companies incapable of responding to change are often those that define how market research is habitually done, how such analysis is translated into financial projections, how plans and budgets are negotiated, and how those numbers are delivered, and so on. These typically inflexible processes are where many organizations' most serious disabilities in coping with change reside. The third class of factors that affect what an organization can or cannot accomplish is its values. The values of an organization are the criteria by which decisions about priorities are made. Some corporate values are ethical in tone, such as those that guide decisions to ensure patient well-being at Johnson & Johnson, or that guide decisions about plant safety at Alcoa. But within the resources, processes, values, or RPV framework, values have a broader meaning. An organization's values are the standards by which employees make prioritization decisions, by which they judge whether an order is attractive or unattractive, whether a customer is more important or less important, whether an idea for a new product is attractive or marginal, and so on. Prioritization decisions are made by employees at every level. At the executive tiers, they often take the form of decisions to invest or not invest in new products, services, and processes. Among salespeople, they consist of on-the-spot, day-to-day decisions about which products to push with customers and which not to emphasize. The larger and more complex a company becomes, the more important it is for senior managers to train employees at every level to make independent decisions about priorities that are consistent with the strategic direction and the business model of the company. A key metric of good management, in fact, is whether such clear and consistent values have permeated the organization. Clear, consistent, and broadly understood values, however, also define what an organization cannot do. A company's values, by necessity, must reflect its cost structure or its business model, because these define the rules its employees must follow in order for the company to make money. If, for example, the structure of a company's overhead costs requires it to achieve gross profit margins of 40%, a powerful value or decision rule will have evolved that encourages middle managers to kill ideas that promise gross margins below 40%. This means that such an organization would be incapable of successfully commercializing projects targeting low-margin markets. For example, in order for a $40 million company to grow 25%, it needs to find $10 million in new business the next year. For a $40 billion company to grow 25%, it needs to find $10 billion in new business the next year. The size of market opportunity that will solve each of these companies' needs for growth is very different. As I said earlier, an opportunity that excites a small organization isn't big enough to be interesting to a very large one. One of the bittersweet rewards of success is, in fact, that as companies become large, they literally lose the capability to enter small, emerging markets. The explanation lies in the RPV framework of organizational capabilities. Industry leaders develop and introduce sustaining technologies over and over again. Month after month, year after year, as they introduce new and improved products in order to gain an edge over the competition, the leading companies develop processes for evaluating the technological potential and assessing their customers' needs for alternative sustaining technologies. In the parlance of this program, the organizations develop a capability for doing these things which reside in their processes. Sustaining technology investments also fit the values of the leading companies in that they promise higher margins from better products sold to their leading-edge customers. On the other hand, disruptive innovations occur so intermittently that no company has a routinized process for handling them. Furthermore, because the disruptive products promise lower profit margins per unit sold and cannot be used by their best customers, these innovations are inconsistent with the leading company's values. The leading disk drive companies had the resources, for example, the people, money, and technology, required to succeed at both sustaining and disruptive technologies. But their processes and values constituted disabilities in their efforts to succeed at disruptive technologies. Large companies often surrender emerging growth markets because smaller, disruptive companies are actually more capable of pursuing them. Though startups lack resources, it doesn't matter. Their values can embrace small markets, and their cost structures can accommodate lower margins. Their market research and resource allocation processes allow managers to proceed intuitively, rather than having to be backed up by careful research and analysis. All of these advantages add up to enormous opportunity, or looming disaster, depending upon your perspective. Managers who face the need to change or innovate, therefore, need to do more than assign the right resources to the problem. They need to be sure that the organization in which those resources will be working is itself capable of succeeding. And in making that assessment, managers must scrutinize whether the organization's processes and values fit the problem. Managers who determine that an organization's capabilities aren't suited for a new task are faced with three options through which to create new capabilities. They can acquire a different organization whose processes and values are a close match with the new task, or try to change the processes and values of the current organization. Or they can separate out an independent organization and develop within it the new processes and values that are required to solve the new problem. Cisco Systems' acquisitions process has worked well because its managers seem to have kept resources, processes, and values in the right perspective. Between 1993 and 1997, it acquired primarily small companies that were less than 2 years old, early-stage organizations whose market value was built primarily upon their resources, particularly engineers and products. Cisco has a well-defined, deliberate process by which it essentially plugs these resources into the parent's processes and systems, and it has a carefully cultivated method of keeping the engineers of the acquired company happily on the Cisco payroll. In the process of integration, Cisco throws away whatever nascent processes and values came with the acquisition, because those weren't what Cisco paid for. On a couple of occasions, when the company acquired a larger, more mature organization, notably its 1996 acquisition of Stratacom, Cisco did not integrate. Rather, it let Stratacom stand alone and infused its substantial resources into the organization to help it grow at a more rapid rate. On at least three occasions, Johnson & Johnson has used acquisitions to establish a position in an important wave of disruptive technology. Its businesses in disposable contact lenses, endoscopic surgery, and diabetes blood glucose meters were all acquired when they were small, were allowed to stand alone, and were infused with resources. Each has become a billion-dollar business. Lucent Technologies and Nortel followed a similar strategy for catching the wave of routers, based upon packet switching technology that were disrupting their traditional circuit switching equipment. But they made these acquisitions late, and the firms they acquired, Ascend Communications and Bay Networks respectively, were extraordinarily expensive because they had already created the new market application, data networks, along with the much larger Cisco systems, and they were right on the verge of attacking the voice network. Companies that have gone the second route and tried to develop new capabilities within established organizational units also have a spotty track record, unfortunately. Assembling a beefed-up set of resources as a means of changing what an existing organization can do is relatively straightforward. People with new skills can be hired, technology can be licensed, capital can be raised, and product lines, brands, and information can be acquired. Too often, however, resources such as these are then plugged into fundamentally unchanged processes, and little change results. For example, through the 1970s and 80s, Toyota upended the world automobile industry through its innovation in development, manufacturing, and supply chain processes without investing aggressively in resources such as advanced manufacturing or information processing technology. General Motors responded by investing nearly $60 billion in manufacturing resources, computer automated equipment that was designed to reduce cost and improve quality. Using state-of-the-art resources in antiquated processes, however, made little difference in General Motors' performance because it's in its processes and values that the organization's most fundamental capabilities lie. Processes and values define how resources, many of which can be bought and sold, hired and fired, are combined to create value. Unfortunately, processes are very hard to change for two reasons. The first is that organizational boundaries are often drawn to facilitate the operation of present processes. Those boundaries can impede the creation of new processes that cut across those boundaries. When new challenges require different people or groups to interact differently than they habitually have done, addressing different challenges with different timing than historically had been required, managers need to pull the relevant people out of the existing organization and draw a new boundary around a new group. New team boundaries enable or facilitate new patterns of working together that ultimately can coalesce as new processes, new capabilities for transforming inputs into outputs. The second reason new process capabilities are hard to develop is that, in some cases, managers don't want to throw the existing processes out. The methods work perfectly well in doing what they were designed to do. As noted above, while resources tend to be flexible and can be used in a variety of situations, processes and values are, by their very nature, inflexible. Their very raison d'être is to cause the same thing to be done consistently over and over again. Processes are meant not to change. When disruptive change appears on the horizon, managers need to assemble the capabilities to confront the change before it has affected the mainstream business. In other words, they need an organization that is geared toward the new challenge before the old one, whose processes are tuned to the existing business model, has reached a crisis that demands fundamental change. Because of its task-specific nature, it is impossible to ask one process to do two fundamentally different things. The market research and planning processes that are appropriate for the launch of new products into existing markets simply aren't capable of guiding a company into emerging, poorly defined markets. And the processes by which a company would experimentally and intuitively feel its way into emerging markets would constitute suicide if employed in a well-defined existing business. If a company needs to do both types of tasks simultaneously, then it needs two very different processes. And it is very difficult for a single organizational unit to employ fundamentally different, opposing processes. This is why managers need to create different teams within which different processes to address new problems can be defined and redefined. The third mechanism for new capability creation, spawning them within spin-out ventures, is currently in vogue among many managers as they wrestle with how to address the Internet. When are spin-outs a crucial step in building new capabilities to exploit change? And what are the guidelines by which they should be managed? A separate organization is required when the mainstream organization's values would render it incapable of focusing resources on the innovation project. How separate does the effort need to be? The primary requirement is that the project cannot be forced to compete with projects in the mainstream organization for resources. Because values are the criteria by which prioritization decisions are made, projects that are inconsistent with a company's mainstream values will naturally be accorded lowest priority. Whether the independent organization is physically separate is less important than its independence from the normal resource allocation process. In our studies of this challenge, we have never seen a company succeed in addressing a change that disrupts its mainstream values absent the personal, attentive oversight of the CEO, precisely because of the power of processes and values, and particularly the logic of the normal resource allocation process. Only the CEO can ensure that the new organization gets the required resources and is free to create processes and values that are appropriate to the new challenge. CEOs who view spin-outs as a tool to get disruptive threats off their personal agendas are almost certain to meet with failure. We have seen no exceptions to this rule. To sum up, managers whose organizations are confronting change must first determine that they have the resources required to succeed. They then need to ask a separate question. Does the organization have the processes and values to succeed? Asking this second question is not as instinctive for most managers because the processes by which work is done and the values by which employees make their decisions have served them well. What I hope this framework adds to managers' thinking, however, is that the very capabilities of their organizations also define their disabilities. A little time spent soul-searching for honest answers to this issue will pay off handsomely. Are the processes by which work habitually gets done in the organization appropriate for this new problem? And will the values of the organization cause this initiative to get high priority or to languish? If the answer to these questions is no, it's okay. Understanding problems is the most crucial step in solving them. Wishful thinking about this issue can set teams charged with developing and implementing an innovation on a course fraught with roadblocks, second-guessing, and frustration. The reasons why innovation often seems to be so difficult for established firms is that they employ highly capable people and then set them to work within processes and values that weren't designed to facilitate success with the task at hand. Ensuring that capable people are ensconced in capable organizations is a major management responsibility in an age such as ours, when the ability to cope with accelerating change has become so critical. Performance provided, market demand, and the product life cycle. In each of the several industries we've explored, when leading firms have stumbled from positions of industry leadership, technologists were able to provide rates of performance improvement that have exceeded the rates of performance improvement that the market has needed or was able to absorb. Historically, when this performance oversupply occurs, it creates an opportunity for a disruptive technology to emerge and subsequently to invade established markets from below. As it creates this threat or opportunity for a disruptive technology, performance oversupply also triggers a fundamental change in the basis of competition in the product's market. The rank ordering of the criteria by which customers choose one product or service over another will change, signaling a transition from one phase, variously defined by management theorists, to the next of the product life cycle. In other words, the intersecting trajectories of performance supplied and performance demanded are fundamental triggers behind the phases in the product life cycle. Generally, once the performance level demanded of a particular attribute has been achieved, customers indicate their satiation by being less willing to pay a premium price for continued improvement in that attribute. Hence, performance oversupply triggers a shift in the basis of competition, and the criteria used by customers to choose one product over another changes to attributes for which market demands are not yet satisfied. The marketing literature provides numerous descriptions of the product life cycle and of the ways in which the characteristics of products within given categories evolve over time. My findings suggest that for many of these models, performance oversupply is an important factor driving the transition from one phase of the cycle to the next. Consider, for example, the product evolution model called the buying hierarchy by its creators, Windermere Associates of San Francisco, California, which describes as typical the following four phases: functionality, reliability, convenience, and price. Initially, when no available product satisfies the functionality requirement of the market, the basis of competition, or the criteria by which product choice is made, tends to be product functionality. Sometimes, as in disk drives, a market may cycle through several different functionality dimensions. Once two or more products credibly satisfy the market's demand for functionality, however, customers can no longer base their choice of products on functionality, but tend to choose a product and vendor based on reliability. As long as market demand for reliability exceeds what vendors are able to provide, customers choose products on this basis, and the most reliable vendors of the most reliable products earn a premium for it. But when two or more vendors improve to the point that they more than satisfy the reliability demanded by the market, the basis of competition shifts to convenience. Customers will prefer those products that are the most convenient to use and those vendors that are most convenient to deal with. Again, as long as the market demand for convenience exceeds what vendors are able to provide, customers choose products on this basis and reward vendors with premium prices for the convenience they offer. Finally, when multiple vendors offer a package of convenient products and services that fully satisfies market demand, the basis of competition shifts to price. The factor driving the transition from one phase of the buying hierarchy to the next is performance oversupply. This evolving pattern in the basis of competition, from functionality to reliability and convenience, and finally to price, has been seen in many of the cases so far discussed. In fact, a key characteristic of a disruptive technology is that it heralds a change in the basis of competition. Two additional important characteristics of disruptive technologies consistently affect product life cycles and competitive dynamics. First, the attributes that make disruptive products worthless in mainstream markets typically become their strongest selling points in emerging markets. And second, disruptive products tend to be simpler, cheaper, and more reliable and convenient than established products. Managers must understand these characteristics to effectively chart their own strategies for designing, building, and selling disruptive products. Even though the specific market applications for disruptive technologies cannot be known in advance, managers can bet on these two regularities. Let's look at the first point, that the weaknesses of disruptive technologies are their strengths. In general, companies that have succeeded in disruptive innovation initially took the characteristics and capabilities of the technology for granted and sought to find or create a new market that would value or accept those attributes. Thus, Connor Peripherals created a market for small drives and portable computers where smallness was valued. J.C. Bamford and J.I. Case built a market for excavators among residential contractors, where small buckets and tractor mobility, rather than already existing large machinery, actually created value. In the instances studied in this program, established firms confronted with disruptive technology typically viewed their primary development challenge as a technological one, to improve the disruptive technology enough that it suits known markets. In contrast, the firms that were most successful in commercializing a disruptive technology were those framing their primary development challenge as a marketing one, to build or find a market where product competition occurred along dimensions that favored the disruptive attributes of the product. It is critical that managers confronting disruptive technology observe this principle. If history is any guide, companies that keep disruptive technologies bottled up in their labs, working to improve them until they suit mainstream markets, will not be nearly as successful as firms that find markets that embrace the attributes of disruptive technologies as they initially stand. These latter firms, by creating a commercial base and then moving up market, will ultimately address the mainstream market much more effectively than will firms that have framed disruptive technology as a laboratory rather than a marketing challenge. Now, my second point, that disruptive technologies are typically simpler, cheaper, and more reliable and convenient than established technologies. When performance oversupply has occurred and a disruptive technology attacks the underbelly of a mainstream market, the disruptive technology often succeeds, both because it satisfies the market's need for functionality in terms of the buying hierarchy and because it is simpler, cheaper, and more reliable and convenient than mainstream products. Because established companies are so prone to push for high-performance, high-profit products and markets, they find it very difficult not to overload their first disruptive products with features and functionality. Apple, for example, stretched the functionality of its Newton instead of initially targeting simplicity and reliability. The research summarized in this program suggests that perhaps the most powerful protection that small entrant firms enjoy as they build the emerging markets for disruptive technologies is that they're doing something that it simply does not make sense for the established leaders to do. Despite their endowments in technology, brand names, manufacturing prowess, management experience, distribution muscle, and just plain cash, successful companies populated by good managers have a genuinely hard time doing what does not fit their model for how to make money. Because disruptive technologies rarely make sense during the years when investing in them is most important, Conventional managerial wisdom at established firms constitutes an entry and mobility barrier that entrepreneurs and investors can bank on. It is powerful and pervasive. Established companies can surmount this barrier, however. The dilemmas posed to innovators by the conflicting demands of sustaining and disruptive technologies can be resolved. Managers must first understand what these intrinsic conflicts are. They then need to create a context in which each organization's market position, economic structure, developmental capabilities, and values are sufficiently aligned with the power of their customers that they assist rather than impede the very different work of sustaining and disruptive innovators. I hope this program helps them in this effort.
This has been a HighBridge Audio presentation.